Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show.
Four past the hour on the 5th of April. I'm Dick Whitworth. It's a real joy to be with you today. Bill will be back in studio tomorrow, and I know you're looking forward to that as well, and as I am. Our verse for today is Ephesians chapter 2, 14 through 16. For he himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, by setting aside in his flesh the law with its commands and regulations. His purpose was to create in himself one new humanity out of the two, thus making peace, and in one body to reconcile both of them to God through the cross by which he put to death their hostility. Great verse today, and by the way, that is our verse of the day on Faith Radio. If you're not regularly signed up to receive yours, we have a daily verse that will arrive in your inbox via email. You can find out more at our website, myfaithradio.com. So I mentioned a few moments ago, Dr. Peter Kapsner is in the house. He's in the building, and we'll be talking to him a little bit in just a few moments about YouTube and some of the scary things, the interesting things that are taking place in that realm, and also just talking about life in general. It's always great to have Peter with Bill. I look forward, as a listener, this is one of my favorite times of the week as they interact, because you never know what Bill's going to say, right?
I mean, I don't.
I
have no clue.
I think that's what makes his show so interesting and exciting, because none of us know, and we don't want to put him in a box. So he'll be back tomorrow morning, but Dr. Peter Kapsner is up next on the Early Morning Late Show. That's the walk-up music for the one and only Dr. Peter Kapsner, a professor at Northwestern, and always an invited special guest to the Early Morning Late Show, Dr. Kapsner. Peter, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here again this morning.
Yeah. A rabid teacher.
Well, yeah, I was appreciative of your story, because, you know, I was foaming at the mouth again this morning. I thought it was the mouthwash, but, you know, I kind of blocked out that dog bite deal, and so I feel much better in terms of the explanation now.
I am so glad to know that. That is the case.
Yeah, indeed.
Hey, you know, it is great to have you with us literally every week, because certainly because of your work with students, you put us in touch with culture. When most of us watch TV or we see some of these things that are happening, it's like, you know, the plane over my head kind of thing. It's like, how? What are they thinking? I remember as a youth not being very bright and doing some very scary kind of risky things, but they have... Seems like this culture has taken things to a whole new level of sometimes scary, sometimes interesting. And YouTube has been an incredible phenomena in terms of what kids are doing today to actually be seen. And talk a little bit about this. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating phenomenon. It's one of those things that, again, I sort of, as you mentioned, I have this incredible fortunate opportunity to be with students for several hours a day on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and you get windows into their lives. And I remember when there was sort of this early movement of, did you see that on YouTube? Did you see that on YouTube? Was this phrase that I didn't really understand what was happening, because any awareness of YouTube that I would have been to go figure out how to fix my kitchen sink.
Sure.
Or, you know, paint a crack in the wall, something along those lines. I didn't realize the kind of content that was being generated on YouTube that young people are no longer watching network TV. They are watching Netflix, sometimes going to movies, but then really attending to YouTube on their phones throughout the day. And just they never light up more than when they're talking with one another about, did you see XYZ or whatever it happens to be on YouTube? And so this is relatively new to me as well in terms of the kind of content that's being generated and where the focus of our young people is to go find that kind of content. And it's a fascinating phenomenon.
Yeah, it, you know, for me, well, I remember when YouTube debuted, it seemed to me to be nothing but kitten kind of videos and things like that. And, you know, it was cute, but, you know, I didn't see any long-lasting value for me in ever visiting YouTube. Occasionally somebody would send me a link to say, oh, this is funny, you've got to see that. But really, I never visit that. But it has, again, as we've just articulated, it has gone to a whole new level. The Tide Pod phenomenon, I know you've talked about here. And there's a new one, and for those of you with little ones, it's a little risky to say, but it's real, and it is happening. It's something about condom snorting. I have no idea what's happening.
Yeah, it's, you know, YouTube can really become a platform where some of these more shocking dimensions of just behavior can, there's this invitation for young people to, instead of just doing it in a Friday night party scene or something like that, if the kind of shocking behavior, they can video it and get a lot of subscribers or watchers, then they can monetize this very quickly. And so to your point, eating these detergent pods, well, you know, it ran kind of roughshod for about 3-4 weeks in our culture. And then that kind of it ran its course. And now the most recent one, as you mentioned, was this idea of snorting condoms and just watching them sort of disappear through your nose and up into your nasal passages. And there's something about that that becomes intriguing. Or having a taser, I saw recently with a person who is tasering a rat. And it's all of these little sort of extreme kinds of things that do get a lot of hits, unfortunately. They play to some of our, you know, worst impulses at times, of course. And in doing so, it doesn't take long before you have a lot of hits, and then you can make actually quite a bit of money at the
end
of the day.
Is that through advertisers who buy? Okay, so if you have a following, then they want to be on your page. Okay.
Yeah, the wealthiest YouTube channel or the person is a guy by the name of Daniel Middleton, and he creates content related to Minecraft. And he gets up every morning and makes videos related to some of the most recent worlds that have been created in Minecraft or the recent characters or whatever it is. And his annual take at this point in time is a little over $16 million annually. And he's a 26-year-old out of the United Kingdom. And he developed a following of 5 to 10-year-olds that they get on almost every day and see the latest that's going on with Minecraft.
Well, this has to be a parent's worst nightmare in some regards, right?
It is. And that's where YouTube really is getting some blowback these days. And it was part of what was behind what happened in the events of the shooting this last week is that the woman doing the shooting historically had a reasonable following on YouTube and was probably able to make some income from that, from the advertisers. And YouTube started losing quite a bit of their advertisers because ads from people like AT&T and other reputable companies started showing up in more extremist channels like terrorist channels or objectionable content. And so they started pulling their money. And of course, YouTube doesn't like it when the advertisers are pulling their money. Follow the money, exactly. So they clamped down real recently on saying, if you want to have ads on your platform, you have to have 4,000 subscribers and you have to have at least 1,000 hours of viewable content every year along these lines. And that really then X'd out a number of people who are trying to make money on YouTube. And that was the case for this young woman who did the shooting in California. She was disenfranchised by YouTube because they'd cut out her monetization.
Wow.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. You're listening to the Early Morning Late Show. Dr. Peter Kapsner is our guest today. I'm Dick Whitworth filling in for Bill. The power of becoming YouTube famous is very seductive. How do you speak to your kids about this?
Yeah, there's so many behaviors, Dick, in our young people that I think have at their core the same kind of question. And I'm always fascinated when I ask my young people the question, do you feel lonely? Do you feel isolated in life? Because, and we've talked about this on the show before, but it's worth repeating that when I ask this question, you would think that these young people that have their phones and they're always connected and sharing photos and Instagram and all of that, that they would feel just incredibly connected and part of something.
Right.
But when I ask them to raise their hand if they feel isolated or lonely, all the hands in the room typically go up, you know, save maybe a couple. And I think what it speaks to, as we talk about it in classes, is I'll ask a follow-up question, which is, do you sense people see you in life? Do you feel seen and noticed? And if people do see you, do you sense that they like what they see? And it's not all that different in some ways. So when I was rolling through high school way back in the 1980s, and you know, that sense of popularity, do I fit in? Do I belong? Were some of the same driving questions. We just didn't have YouTube to then try to present ourselves to to a much broader audience. Are we seen and are we loved? And that really is the driving question I find so often among our young people today.
All right. We're going to be back with more of this discussion on the Early Morning Late Show. Dr. Peter Kapsner is my guest. I'm Dick Whitworth. It is 15 past the hour. Eighteen minutes past the hour. Again, you're listening to the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold. I'm Dick Whitworth in studio with Dr. Peter Kapsner, professor at Northwestern University, the University of Northwestern St. Paul in Bethel Sem, and we're glad to have him with us as a regular part of our Thursday morning get-together. We're going to be talking to Dr. Ann Bradley a little later on from the Institute for Faith Work and Economics, and Peter has consented to stay on and over and
Indeed.
Ask the good questions. I'll set him up, but he'll ask the good questions. You know, let's jump back a little bit. Something you said off mic just a few moments ago. The greatest challenge that parents probably have and aren't even aware of is how often their input, their voices are deconstructed. And I want you to elaborate on this in a moment, in the sense that when kids get on the school bus, they hear things like, oh, parents are so stupid, and or TV is putting down the church or youth group. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's I think it's one of those key dimensions when we were talking earlier about having these questions. And I think we all have them, is do we feel seen? Do we feel loved? And for young people, some of the primary voices in their lives that can help answer that question and create a sense of stability, and this would be psychological research, sociological research across the board, it would be the voice of the parents, and it would be the voice of the surrounding trusted community of the church. And our young people, obviously, as you know, with their phones and with social media, have lots of voices coming at them all day long. And the two voices that I find that are given the least credibility moving forward tend to be the voice of the parents and the voice of the church. And as you said, that's what we hear, don't we, really early, is maybe mom and dad decided not to do X, Y, Z for their child, and their child will say, my parents are so stupid. And you start saying those things among 20 or 30, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, and pretty soon the voice of the parents is really seen as silly or stupid and no longer can speak into the lives of the kids. And the church has become much the same way in terms of there's a decreasing church attendance. There's not that voice of the community that maybe I would have had growing up. And so it's one of those things that where some of those answers to those really difficult questions could come, it's really tricky to try to figure out. So how can we still have a voice of credibility as parents with our youth?
Well, you think about it. I mean, apart from going back to the Stone Age, which is when I grew up.
Right. Yeah, right. I was shortly thereafter.
I mean, the phone was on the wall and had a cord. You could only go so far without pulling the phone off the wall. How do parents or grandparents become heard, or how can they change some of this dynamic that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think it's going to take quite a bit of intentional behavior with us as parents and our grandparents. And I don't know that I know all the answers to those questions, just because we've been sliding down a pathway for so long. So it's not going to be a silver bullet answer that helps that piece of it out. But I do think a real simple step is the idea of phone usage. And I know we talk about this, and I'm sure many parents listening like me fight the idea with our kids about how often they should be on their phones. But I know one family that as soon as their teenagers come in the door, they have a box right by the door, and the children just know they drop their phone in the box, and that's it. They're not going to use them throughout the rest of the day. So at least they have an evening with their parents and their family to be free from all of what's going on in the phones. And in that time, you can start developing a voice of trusted credibility in that. And simply to talk about this stuff with our young people really just matters, to identify the elephants in the room that says, this is hard. It's really hard to live a life where there's so many voices coming at you all day long. That can start creating some space for some conversation in it.
There's a famous youth worker, and he's built his whole ministry on the reality that parents need relationship before rules.
Yeah.
And if you try to establish rules without relationship, you get rebellion.
Yeah.
But relationship with rules, conjures up respect and those kinds of things. And I think sometimes we as parents or grandparents, we react instead of step forward in involvement. But it really does take the grace of God and the patience of Job and others to actually, you know, build those kinds of bridges. And yet the kids really do want to talk.
They really do. And I think you said that really well in terms of the rules piece of it. I know for me, I find as a parent, it's much easier to create a set of rules sort of govern the behavior than it is to take the time and effort and energy to really engage in the relationship. And it's something that I would have to compliment my wife for sure around, as she spends a lot of time simply listening and being present and being available. And, you know, sometimes we think, how can we be a good parent? And what do we have to do to be a good parent? And there's a lot of ways to answer that question. But I know one of those non-measurable ways is how available and how much do we listen and really engage with our kids and not always try to shape them, but simply be there to listen to them. And that's one thing that can really help.
Yeah. I've often thought I would be a great benevolent dictator.
Yeah. I experience you that way here, actually. I mean, I'm kind of shackled down in this chair. So, you know, I had to say some stuff or I was in trouble.
Dare to dream.
Dare to dream. That's really kind of the goal in life.
Indeed.
Benevolent dictator for life.
I love that. I love that goal. I think I read that in Ephesians 14 the other day.
Is that right?
Yeah, indeed.
Well, I heard Vladimir Putin was elected by 76% of the Russians. I also heard in a report shortly thereafter that 24% of Russians are missing. So,
I think that's probably a pretty good explanation for what happened
there. He's a dictator, but not so benevolent.
Indeed.
So, as helping students think through this whole YouTube phenomena again, we never know what's going to take off, do we?
Right, we don't. That's the thing, is we do live in a reactionary mindset, and it is almost impossible to anticipate what is going to go viral and what is not. I mean, if we knew what would happen, I think you and I would go off air right now and go figure out that video, right? That 16 million that Daniel Middleton is making, if we could do that this morning. And so it's impossible to know. So then you're in reactionary mode. And the only way you can really, I think, deal with that is to have frameworks of understanding before even seeing a video. Like, how do we think about these videos? What's being portrayed? How am I going to react? How does it affect me? To ask those kinds of questions on the front end, as opposed to just simply being this passive recipient of the content, we have to ask on the front end with our young people, what are you watching and why, and what do you think is going to go viral? And it helps them just take a step back, as opposed to just being almost this, I don't want to say victim, but, you know, this almost being manipulated to sort of follow with like a deer in headlights so often.
It's a great challenge to be redemptive with YouTube.
It is. It really, and, you know, YouTube can, this isn't to you know, completely destroy YouTube. It can be this powerful channel where we can really reach young people in some really unique and important ways. And I really appreciate some of the ministries out there that are figuring out just how to do that. We can't just sit back and bash YouTube and sit behind the walls and sing Kumbaya. I mean, we need to figure out how it is that we can bring the beauty of Jesus's kingdom into the midst of our young people's space through the mediums that they're used to. And I appreciate those ministries doing that.
Absolutely. Dr. Peter Capster, my guest this half hour, is going to stay with me as we talk to Dr. Ann Bradley in just a few moments. We're going to take a break. It's 26 past the hour. Breakpoint is coming up next on the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold. Thirty-five minutes past the hour, Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics will be joining us in the next segment. But right now, Ray Hollenbach, who's a pastor and author, is talking about trusting God. And he says it can be difficult to extend grace to other people. But Ray encourages us to release those people to God and trust that through his grace, he is working on them.
The challenge of grace is that from the outside, it always seems like people are getting off scot-free. But from the inside, it is the source and the fountainhead of how God deals with us. And it's the grace of God to gently bring us around to to the things that he wants to address in us. But when we look at grace from the outside, we say, Father, why aren't you addressing this or that or the other thing in that guy? But God knows what he's doing with each one of his children. And you see, grace is much more than just a free gift. It's the example of heaven in our lives. And so we have to trust, you do and I do, that God is the Father of each one of his born-again children, and that as a result, he knows exactly how to nurture and to bring them up. Our job is to actually be stewards of grace, and his job is to do the confrontation and the growing.
That was Ray Hollenbach, pastor and author, and if you'd like to hear the entire interview with Ray, it's entitled Living a Grace-Filled Life. If you actually put in the search bar at myfaithradio.com, Deeper Grace, the interview will show up, and you can hear it in its entirety, or you can share it with a family member or friend. 36 past the hour, Dr. Ann Bradley is next on the Early Morning Late Show.
I run across a lot of parents who want to have it all together. In fact, they want the world to know that they have it all together. You and I know, however, that no one's perfect. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Perfection can seem attainable in the idyllic early childhood years when kids are still adorable. But as children grow, families must begin that slow transformation into a home that allows and encourages imperfection. It may come out in the way that we present ourselves to our kids, making sure that they know we make mistakes and ask for forgiveness when we do. Then try and foster an atmosphere of acceptance in your home for all the imperfections that come with being human.
Are you struggling with your teen? Get a free online parenting course called Tough Guys and Drama Queens at freeparentingcourse.com.
Eight past the hour, the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold. I'm Dick Whitworth filling in for Bill. Bill will be back in studio tomorrow morning. But we are privileged today to have Dr. Ann Bradley joining us. She's the from the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. Dr. Bradley, welcome. Dr. Peter Kapsner is also in the house, so this should be a fun conversation. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Dick. Good morning, Peter. It's lovely to be here again.
Well, we are grateful to have you with us in Minnesota, for example. It's April 5th, and we have about 3 or 4 inches of snow on the ground. We're really we're having an oxymoronic relationship with spring. We can't quite get it together.
It's the 94th day of January, right?
Yes. Something like that. Good answer. Good answer. You know, I was really glad that you were on today for a variety of reasons. One, I always enjoy hearing you. You do a great job in helping us really make sense of the economic world in which we live. But I wanted to talk to you before I even saw the topic about the trade wars that are going on. And candidly, I'm well past the age that I should understand all these things, but I really don't. And when they start talking about a trade surplus and a trade deficit, wow, can you kind of set the stage for some of our discussion this morning about how this whole trade war, economic trading with other countries actually works?
I'd love to. This is just a topic that I teach on a lot. It's really near and dear to my heart. So thank you for a great question. You know, just to set the stage kind of for the basics in terms of the economics of it, which I think is part of what you're asking for in your question.
Yes, please.
You know, there's a reason that if you look across the ideological spectrum, professional economists, whether they identify as left or right, at least in academic circles, tend to be universally in favor of free trade. Now, why would that be? The reason that they tend to be in favor of more trade rather than less is because trade allows us to economize on our time, which means everybody is better off. And so, you know, that's just kind of something that we understand in our daily lives very well. When you think about what you did this morning to prepare for your day, you didn't make most of what you used. You imported it, if you will, right? So I didn't make my shampoo or my toothbrush or my toothpaste or Honey Nut Cheerios. None of it. I outsourced it. other people figured out how to do those things pretty well, and they compete to give me really good products at lower prices. So we understand that. And to answer your question about the trade deficit in this example, I have a trade deficit with my grocery store every single week. What does that mean? It means I'm an importer. I go in with money. The aisles are fully stocked. And that alone makes me wealthier than I would otherwise be. So rewind 250 years ago, how did most people get their breakfast? Well, they worked really hard on the farm. And it's because they didn't have wide circles of exchange, meaning they didn't have a lot of people to trade with. So those are kind of the basic economics of it. Now, how do we think about this with China or trade wars, or what should we do with, you know, kind of political leaders that we don't like their behavior? And I think what we need to remember first and foremost is that most trade is people to people, meaning when I buy an iPad or an Apple Watch or whatever, I am trading with hundreds and thousands of people. I'm trading with some people in China that have jobs in manufacturing plants that put the iPad together. But there's a bigger supply chain of resources. So some of the parts come from Africa and Indonesia. Some of the intellectual design and engineering comes from Germany and the United States. So you're really trading not with countries, but with people. And we need to keep that at the forefront of the discussion of trade wars, because when we engage in a trade war, what we mean is that we make it harder for ordinary people, you and me, but also ordinary people in India, China, wherever, to kind of economize and get more access to goods and services. So we want to be very careful about when we would do that.
So, and Anne, as you talk about that, what kind of impact, when I see these numbers come across the ticker of a $200 or $300 billion trade deficit, and I'm, mm-hmm. you know, just a professor or a businessman or a teacher or at home or maybe even a farmer, any kind of profession, why should I be concerned about that deficit, or should I be concerned? Because I'm hearing in your conversation there's some good about this, but maybe there's some risk as well. So how should I attend to that kind of number, and why?
Yeah, it's a great question also. I think the trade deficit is totally overblown in terms of a concern, and that's just my view as an economist. And this is why, again, trade is always, you know, you give me goods and I give you money, or the other way around. And so what we want trade to be based upon is what people are good at doing and the type of resources that they have. So no country is solely an importer or solely an exporter. And so we all countries do both. And that's a good thing, because God designed us all as people to be different. And different parts of the world have different resources. So it makes sense that you both import and export. Now, so trade deficits don't bother me, because if you're exporting more, if you're importing more than you're exporting, that could be a sign of being very wealthy. In terms of, you know, our relationship with China, if we import a lot of cheap consumer goods, that means that we don't have to produce them here. And that means that Americans can produce more expensive things that require more sophisticated labor. So there's kind of a whole conversation there, too. Now, where can it be risky is if trade becomes political. And what I mean by that is to say, well, we want the United States, for example, I'm just making, you know, this as an example. We want the United States to be a steel exporter. Now, if trade doesn't dictate that you're a steel exporter, if it actually trade dictates that you're a steel importer, then trying to engineer yourself as a major exporter means you're distorting the economy. And with that, you're going to distort jobs, distort production, and distort good stewardship, because if it's not natural that America is a major steel exporter, maybe it is. I'm just giving you an example.
Sure.
So the market tends to dictate this, not politics. So I think trade deficits could be bad if the trade isn't natural, if that makes sense.
I think so. Here's
it's
what we're
complicated,
gonna.
Isn't it?
Oh my! That, and honestly, that's why I'm really glad you're here today. We're gonna talk more with Dr. Anne Bradley from the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, because this is relevant, and we'll explain why here in just a moment. You're listening to the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold. We'll be back in just a moment.
We'll be right back.
47 minutes past the hour. You're listening to the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold. I'm Dick Whitworth filling in for Bill. He is back in the studio tomorrow morning, and it'll be a great time. I know you'll look forward to that. Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics is our guest this segment. Love having Ann on. And yes, Ann, this is complicated. You know, I'm the guy that my freshman year of high school math was the best 3 years of my life. I'm just telling you, I don't get all of what you're talking about. But I do understand this. I before me right now, I was telling Peter, Dr. Peter Kapsner, who is also in the studio, that there are three state stories. I have a story from Minnesota, from Iowa, and North Dakota. They are all soybean producers and exporters. In fact, Minnesota is the third largest producer of soybeans in the nation, and they are absolutely panicked with a 25% tariff on soybeans exported from the United States. Help me understand what that is actually saying and meaning.
Sure. So what this means, and there's, I think, this trade war, so to speak, accelerates, then China and any country would do this is going to retaliate and kind of slap on a tax on exports of soybeans. And so states that are natural producers of soybeans have good reason to be worried. So what this means is that, again, think about what the way to think about these kind of trade relationships is, what would the economy left to its own devices naturally do? Well, it seems like these certain states would produce soybeans and they would send them across the world because it's cheaper for people across the world to buy soybeans from the United States than to produce them at home. In the same way, it's cheaper for us to import things. So the relationships, you know, kind of are true all the way around. And when there's the threat of a tariff on that, it essentially acts as a tax. And so it's going to make it harder for people across the world, or particularly in China in this case, to want to purchase. I mean, that's the whole idea of the tariff, is to say, we don't like what you're doing. So in response, we're going to make it really expensive for our citizens to buy American soybeans. And so what that – it worries the producers, because now they're going to have all these soybeans. And again, the natural market response was to have these customers in China buy them.
Sure.
They're not going to do that anymore. And so it distorts American production and it hurts American jobs. And so we, you know, again, we need to be careful about what we agitate for, because it can have real consequences for ordinary people.
Peter has a question, but I, in the words of Al Gore, why can't we just get along? That's what I want to know.
Why can't we just be friends?
Yes,
right?
That's right.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and that's just it. Because the question, I think it begs the question, is where does this end? And I was reading some things this morning where they were making some parallels between the trade war and the brinksmanship of today with Ronald Reagan and the Soviet Union, and the nuclear brinksmanship that we had in the 80s. Where does this end? Where do you see this headed?
Yeah, you know, so trade wars are very expensive in the most fundamental way of thinking of that word. And what they do, again, is all the things we've talked about. They raise prices for all consumers. I mean, you need to think about it. The political leadership in China is going to eat just fine. That's what we need to remember about all of this stuff. They're going to do just fine. The oligarchs always do. They commandeer resources. So what ends up happening is ordinary people really get harmed. And so I think there's a lot of moral considerations here. And how does this accelerate? You know, if the trade wars keep mounting and they are retaliated against, it will have significant impact on the economy, but I really think that China stands to lose a lot more than the United States does. And, you know, we need to be worried about that, because our fellow human beings in China are experiencing, the great escape from poverty. We've seen that over the past 40 years. And as Christians, we need to say we want that for them. That's a good thing. And we don't want this to hurt those ordinary people. And the reason I say it will hurt China more is because they don't have the robust economy yet that the United States does. And remember, you know, kind of one of the fundamental principles of trade is, when trade is between people and it's voluntary, then it's good. It's helping both parties. And so we want to be careful about restricting that. So, you know, I think that China can't afford this. The U.S. can afford it in a different way because we're richer. But that said, look at the soybean farmers. Those are the type of people that get hurt. You know, the president of the United States is going to eat just fine. It's ordinary people that we need to be worried about. And so I think that China can't really withstand this. America has a lot of trading partners. China is building up trading partners, but because of their political behavior, they don't have a very good reputation. And so, you know, harming trade is not going to help them. So I think ultimately this, it won't cause their economy to collapse because I view it as a game that really doesn't have a win. So I think it will just ultimately stop. But, you know, it can be taken farther and farther. And again, the concern that I have is what happens to the ordinary people on the ground? And, you know, how are we distorting the economy and how are we hurting jobs? How are we raising prices? We don't want to do that.
In the couple of minutes we have left, Anne, is there, from your perspective, a balanced approach to this? I mean, is it free market, buyer beware, winner win kind of thing? What would be, mm-hmm. in an ideal world, the Anne Bradley solution?
What a great sum. The Anne Bradley solution is really do not interfere with markets when, you know, as much as possible. Don't interfere with markets, because what we know about markets, you know, they're not, there's something satisfying about being an engineer, right? Because you design a system and the system has a beginning and it has an end and you understand the functionality. It can be designed. Now, that doesn't mean it's easy. It's hard to be an engineer, but economies are not engineered. And so what trade wars do is they try to reorient trade in a specific way. And I think what's amazing and miraculous about economies is that when ordinary people, again, are allowed to use their gifts and be entrepreneurs and do all sorts of things, you never know what you're going to get next. And the past 250 years have shown profound innovations. We're living longer. We're living healthier. And that's not just for rich people. It's for everybody. So, you know, my world would be people are best off when they're allowed to trade as much as possible. Now, there's a moral framework that needs to undergird that, of course. So I wouldn't say that, you know, we should disregard those considerations, but I do think global trade is the best thing we've seen for escaping poverty ever. There's nothing that compares to it. So we want to really hasten that as much as possible.
So, Anne, is there any risk, though, too? The one thing I do hear is the theft of intellectual property. You mentioned engineers, mm-hmm. that spend their life developing things, and then it can just be stolen, mm-hmm. by other countries. So quickly, in our last few seconds here, anything around that you think has some merit?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this is hard because we're talking about intellectual property rights, and so we need others to respect those. So how do you engage in contracts where you can enforce the respect of intellectual property rights, which is not a tangible thing. It's not like a fence, right? So it's much harder. And so I think, you know, this is a good question, and I think we need to engage in trade agreements where we can provide the right incentives for people to respect ours and we respect theirs. So to me, this is a property rights question that I think needs some more work. But I think we can get there. I really think that we can get there, but it's a sophisticated problem that needs solution. Cause you're right. I mean, especially when we're talking about rogue governments.
Yes. Yeah.
Hijacking these property rights. How do you protect against that? And I think we need to be a lot more sophisticated, about how we do that.
Dr. Anne Bradley, with the Institute for Faith, Work and Economics, our guest, this segment, if you'd like to hear the interview over again, check back at our website a little later this morning at myfaithradio.com, and you can hear it in its entirety. More with the Early Morning Late Show in just a moment. Past the hour. Thank you for joining us this week on the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold. Bill is back in studio tomorrow. It's going to be a great day. Again, special thanks to Dr. Peter Kapsner, professor of the University of Northwestern, also Dr. Anne Bradley, for a great second hour. Again, if you'd like to hear this program in its entirety, you can visit our website, myfaithradio.com, in just a few moments. And we'll be able to have both hours available for your review and listening pleasure. Don't forget, this coming Tuesday, it is Spring Share for Faith Radio. It's a time of year we invite you, encourage you to join us in the support of Faith Radio, keeping, well, not only programs on the air, but going and growing. Find out more at our website, myfaithradio.com.
Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.